People sometimes wince when they see photographs of themselves, and several studies show people prefer the face that they glimpse in a reflection. Does a glassy surface reveal your countenance at its objectively most beautiful? Probably not. It's just the face you like, because you're used to seeing it that way. The preference for familiarity is so universal that some think it must be written into our genetic code from back when our ancestors trawled the savanna. The evolutionary explanation for the exposure effect is simple. If you recognize an animal or plant, then it hasn't killed you yet. The philosopher Martin Heidegger once said, "Every man is born as many men and dies a single one." There are a handful of preferences shared by almost all infants, for example, for sweet foods and harmonies without dissonance. But adult tastes are diverse, in large part because they're shaped by the experience of life, and each person enjoys and suffers life in a different way. People are born average and die unique. There is nothing more important to the preservation of the hunter-gatherer groups than having sex and moving from place to place safely. So let's consider these two pillars of their psychology. What makes a face beautiful? What makes a landscape desirable? To see the potential origins of a bias toward the familiar. It's commonly said that people like faces that are symmetrical. But horizontal equivalence alone isn't the best predictor of beauty. Think about it. Can't you tell how attractive somebody is by just looking at one side of their face? And making an unappealing face perfectly symmetrical doesn't suddenly create a supermodel. The more scientifically rigorous explanation for beauty is that people are attracted to faces that look like lots of other faces. When it comes to looks, average is truly beautiful. Several studies using computer simulations have shown that blending many faces of the same gender creates a countenance more attractive than its individuals. If you blend a lot of extremely good-looking people together, the composite is even more bewitching. What's so beautiful about an average face? Scientists aren't quite sure. Perhaps it's evolutionary and a face of many faces suggests genetic diversity. In any case, the appeal is universal and perhaps even innate. In studies of adults and children based in China and throughout Europe and the United States, the most average faces are judged to be the most attractive. Beyond averageness, however, tastes diverge wildly. There is no universal attraction to lip plates, lipstick, or bangs, even though you can find thousands of people around the world who find each to be seductive. Many people think glasses are sexy, but this is quite evolutionarily backward. Requiring precisely calibrated glassware technology to go about your day signals bad genes for vision. Ancient hunter-gatherers probably wouldn't have been smitten by wires resting on the nose and ears to balance optical lenses in front of one's eyes. But this doesn't diminish the popularity of the sexy librarian fantasy. If biological preferences for faces exist, they are soft clay, and culture can mold it into myriad shapes. Another place to see the branching of adult preferences from a common origin is in scenery. A global study of landscape pictures like rainforests, savannas, and deserts found that children around the world seem to prefer the same topography. It looks like a savanna with tree cover, which happens to resemble the East African landscape where the Homo sapiens species may have originated. It would appear that humans are born with what the professor of philosophy of art Dennis Dutton calls a pervasive Pleistocene taste in landscape. But adult tastes for scenery are neither pervasive nor Pleistocene. They're all over the place. Some people prefer the sharp canine tooth of the Matterhorn Peak, some love a main pond painted pink by the sunset, and others are partial to Morocco's burnt orange ergs. Some landscape details seem to be universally appealing. For example, people around the world are drawn to the presence of clean-looking water, an ancient and eternal necessity for life. There is some evidence that onlookers from various backgrounds and cultures are attracted to mountains divided by snaking rivers and forests cut by trails that slink away toward a vanishing point. These details signify something human ancestors would have loved to see, a navigable path through the chaos of nature. But as adults see different movies, calendars, magazines, photographs, and vistas, their impression of the perfect landscape branches off in a million directions. In the final analysis, beauty does not reside in forms or cosmic ratios or even in the standard issue wiring of humans' minds, hearts, and guts. It exists in the interplay between the world and people, which is to say, in life. People adapt. To paraphrase Tennyson, they are the sum of all they have met. They are born average and die unique. Before there were social media feeds, before there were cable networks or television broadcast stations, and even before there were modern national newspapers, there were public museums. Not counting the amphitheater, the public museum was arguably the first technology to distribute artistic works, what is now collectively known as content, to a mass audience. It is strange, perhaps, to think of the museum as anything like a modern innovation, since to many it brings to mind antiquity, mothballs, and young children announcing that they have to pee. But like so much technology, from steam engines to smartphones, the public museum democratized a market, artworks and artifacts, making available to the masses that which was previously accessible only to the rich. Although crowds have gawked at publicly displayed art for millennia, most art collections throughout history have been private and closely guarded by royals. The modern public museum was an invention of the Enlightenment and its radical notion that ordinary plebs deserved an education. The first national public museum was the British Museum, which opened in 1759 as a cabinet of curiosities, including artifacts from ancient Egypt and flora from Jamaica. National museums flowered throughout Europe and across the Atlantic in the next few decades. The American polymath Charles Wilson Peale founded America's first modern public museum in Philadelphia in 1786, with thousands of species of plants and paintings of animals from his collection. The Louvre opened in Paris in 1793, and the Prado in Madrid followed in 1819. The Caillebotte bequest graced the walls of the Musée de Luxembourg at the height of this craze for new public museums in Europe. In the second half of the 20th century, 100 museums opened in Britain alone. If public museums have been for several hundred years the most important real estate in art, then radio has been the public museum of pop music, the great hallway of mass exposure. Airplay was so critical to building popularity for new music in the mid-20th century that music labels developed elaborate payola schemes to directly pay radio stations to play their songs. Even into this century, omnipresent airplay is critical to make a hit. Every bit of consumer research we've ever done shows only one consistent thing. Radio is the number one driver of sales and the biggest predictor of a song's success, says Dave Bakula, Senior Vice President of Analytics at Nielsen, which tracks music sales and airplay. You almost invariably see the biggest songs hit radio first, then pick up in other platforms. Public exposure on radio can be even more powerful than mere exposure, because a song's presence on a top 40 station offers other cues about its quality, like the sense that tastemakers and other listeners have already heard and endorsed it. Even at the dawn of the American music business, to make a song a hit, a memorable melody was secondary to an ingenious marketing campaign. In Tin Pan Alley, what publishers understood was that no matter how clever, how catchy, how timely a song, its success depended on its system of distribution, music historian David Sweisman wrote in Selling Sounds, The Commercial Revolution in American Music. In New York City, near the end of the 19th century, writers and publishers near a part of Union Square nicknamed Tin Pan Alley developed an elaborate process of plugging new music. They would pass out song sheets to local musicians, who would play each tune in different neighborhoods from the Lower East Side to the Upper West, and report back on which songs clicked. The American standards that came out of this period, such as The Band Played On, Take Me Out to the Ball Game, and God Bless America, were the products of an elaborate testing and distribution strategy that ran on sheet music and shoe leather. Tin Pan Alley's pluggers gave way to radio, and now radio is giving way to new forms of distribution that are more open, equal, and unpredictable. Today's hits break off TV commercials, Facebook posts, and online videos. A Spotify playlist by Napster co-founder Sean Parker is widely credited with launching Lorde's Royals, the surprise hit of 2013. 2 years earlier, a Canadian singer-songwriter, Carly Rae Jepsen, released a peppy song, Call Me Maybe, that debuted at 97 in the Canadian Hot 100. By the end of the year, it still wasn't in the top 20. But another Canadian pop singer, Justin Bieber, heard the song on the radio and then praised it on Twitter. In early 2012, Bieber made a YouTube video of him and several friends with fake mustaches, including pop star Selena Gomez, dancing to it. That video now has more than 70 million views, and it helped launch Call Me Maybe, which itself has more than 800 million views on YouTube, to become one of the biggest pop songs of the decade. Music, and for that matter, all culture, attaches itself to such moments, and now that moment can come from anywhere. Terrestrial radio still holds great distribution power. After all, that's how Bieber first heard Call Me Maybe. But it no longer has a monopoly on exposure. Every social media account, every blogger, every website, and every promiscuously shared video is essentially a radio station. It would be nice to think that in a cultural market like music, quality is everything, and each number one hit is also the best in class. Plus, it seems awfully hard to prove otherwise. How do you demonstrate that a song nobody has heard of is better than the most popular song in the country? You would need something crazy. A parallel universe to compare, where thousands of people have listened to the same songs and come to different conclusions without the power of marketing. In fact, that parallel universe exists. Music labels consult it all the time. It is the universe of Hit Predictor and Sound Out, online song testing companies that ask thousands of people to evaluate the catchiness of new songs before the general population has formed an opinion about them. As the name suggests, Hit Predictor, which is owned by iHeartMedia, the largest owner of FM and AM radio stations in the United States, predicts what songs will be hits by playing a hook from a new song to an online audience three times without telling them too much else about it. The point is to capture the song's pure catchiness in a vacuum. Audiences give the song a numerical rating. A song can score high into the 100s, but any score above 65 is considered eligible to be a breakout hit. 65 is the threshold. Above that level, a track has the intrinsic appeal to be one of the top songs in the country. Here are the hit predictor ratings of several extremely popular songs that entered the top 5 on the Billboard Hot 100 in the fall of 2015. Hotline Bling by Drake, 70.25. The Hills by The Weeknd, 71.39. Stitches by Shawn Mendes, 71.55. Sorry by Justin Bieber, 77.14. What Do You Mean by Justin Bieber, 79.12. Hello by Adele, 105. Think about those numbers for a second. Do you notice something weird? A song can theoretically score in the 100s, but most of these massive hits, and they were all massive hits, are just a few notches above the 65 threshold. There is nothing at 80 or above, except for the incredible outlier of Hello. Keep that mystery in the back of your head for a few moments, because there is something deceptively powerful about all these hits scoring only in the 70s. Soundout is a similar company based out of the UK, which tests about 10,000 tracks online each month. Each new song is randomly streamed to more than 100 people, who rate it after at least 90 seconds. At Soundout, the magic number is 80, and any song scoring above that threshold, about 5% of tested music, is deemed sufficiently catchy to be a hit. The best performing recording in Soundout history was Adele's sophomore album, 21, which included 3 worldwide number one hits and won the 2012 Grammy Award for Album of the Year. Every song on the 21 album scored above an 80, Soundout founder and CEO David Courtier Dutton told me in late 2015. We've never seen that before, and we've never seen it since. Both Hit Predictor and Soundout find that, yes, there is such a thing as quality or catchiness. Melodies that fail to hit their magic numbers tend to fail in the real world as well. But recall the top hits of late 2015. Songs in the 70s routinely beat dozens, if not hundreds, of songs that scored in the 80s and 90s. Above a certain level, catchiness doesn't make a song a monster hit. Exposure does. For every great song that makes it into the charts and has months of airplay, there are 100 other songs that are just as good, if not better, which if sung by the right artist with the right marketing, would be a smash hit, Soundout's Courtier Dutton said. It is absolutely, categorically true that there are thousands of songs out there that will never see the light of day because they will never get the distribution they require to catch in the market, even though they scored above 80. What's holding back the success of thousands of catchy enough songs? Sometimes they simply lack the marketing might of a label, or the luck of a viral online video, or the support of a celebrity like Justin Bieber. Sometimes DJs don't care about the artist, or the song doesn't fit their playlist. Perhaps the band is recalcitrant and a total pain to market. Perhaps it's several of these things at once. But the point is that every year, hundreds of songs won't become hits, and it will have very little to do with the fact that they weren't catchy enough. It is the Kaibot effect all over again. 2 pop songs come out. Independent surveys determine they are equally catchy. But one song becomes a massive hit, ubiquitous in coffee shops, praised by mainstream music sites, adored by high school students, and even parodied on YouTube. While the second song is widely ignored and ultimately forgotten, because for some reason it never received that crucial moment of public consecration. There are simply too many good enough songs for every worthy hook to become a bona fide hit. Quality, it seems, is a necessary but insufficient attribute for success. Critics and audiences might prefer to think that markets are perfectly meritocratic and that the most popular products and ideas are self-evidently the best. But the universes of Hit Predictor and Sound Out prove that for every hit song you've ever heard, there are hundreds of equally catchy but relatively anonymous melodies that you haven't. Beyond a certain level of songwriting genius, how many times audiences have heard a melody matters more for its popularity than how inherently catchy it is. In a world of scarce media, just one public French museum or just three local radio stations, popularity is more top-down. Hits are easier to control and easier to predict. But today, there are more than 80 museums in New York City alone. On streaming sites like Pandora, Spotify, and Apple Music, there are millions of public and personalized radio stations. The power of the press belongs to anybody with a smartphone. In this bottom-up world, where cultural authority shatters into a million channels of exposure, the hits are harder to foresee, and authority is harder to protect. Consider the nation's most solemn arena for popularity contests, political elections. Politics as entertainment is a common phrase in the press, but the truth might be one letter off. For better or worse, politics is entertainment. Every political campaign is a media organization. Political campaigns spend half their money on advertising. Elected representatives spend 70% of their time engaged in what any sane person would recognize as telemarketing, directly asking for money, asking other people to ask for money, or building relationships with wealthy people, which is a politely indirect way to achieve the same goal. Even governance is showbiz. One-third of the White House staff works in some aspect of public relations to promote the president and his policies, according to political scientists Matthew Baum and Samuel Kernell. The White House is a studio, and the president is its star. But the star power of the presidency has shrunk in the last few decades at the same time that the channels of exposure have grown. The most successful way for a president to shape public opinion is to speak directly to voters. Owning the public's attention used to be a simpler task. In the 1960s and 1970s, CBS, NBC, and ABC accounted for more than 90% of the TV audience. It was a heyday for the bully pulpit. In 1970 alone, President Richard Nixon delivered 9 primetime addresses to the nation. The typical address of both Nixon and his successor, Gerald Ford, reached half of all television-owning households. As the television channels grew, however, the American president became easier to ignore. Ronald Reagan, whose telegenic skills were legendary, reached less than 40% of households on average, and Bill Clinton's loquacious charm got him only to 30%. Meanwhile, the average presidential soundbite on the news shrank from 40 seconds in 1968 to less than 7 seconds in the 1990s. Cable created the golden age of television, but it ended the golden age of presidential communication. The president is shrinking, and so is the political party. For the past half century, the best predictor of a political candidate's electoral success was the so-called invisible primary of endorsements from politicians, party leaders, and donors. According to one theory called the party decides, it is Democratic and Republican elites, not voters, who decide on their favorite candidates, and these authority figures send signals through the media to the obedient rank and file. It is quite like the old information flow of the music industry. Authority figures, labels and DJs, blasted their preferred products, songs, through scarce and powerful channels of exposure, radio stations, and consumers typically obeyed, bought albums. But in the 2016 primaries, the apparent power of advertising all but vanished. The GOP candidates with the most elite support, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, spent about $140 million on television ads through early 2016, but they both flamed out. The GOP candidate with the least elite support, Donald Trump, spent less than $20 million on advertising. But he still won the exposure primary in a landslide because his outrageous statements and improbable candidacy were such irresistible fodder for networks and publishers desperate for audiences. Through the summer of 2016, Trump had earned $3 billion in free media, which was more than the rest of his rivals combined. With the rise of alternative media sources, party elites lost their ability to control the flow of political information to voters, and an unprecedented figure of single-minded celebrity, authoritarian bluster, and nativist bombast ran away with the Republican primary. The party didn't decide. Rather, like the concentration of political media itself, it seemed to dissolve. In politics, as in any industry, there is a product, a marketing strategy, and a buying opportunity, a politician, a campaign, and a vote. In both politics and business, research shows that advertising is most powerful when consumers are clueless. Political advertising, for example, is most potent when voters are ignorant of politics in general or with the choices in one particular election. That's one reason why the influence of money tends to be greater in local elections that voters don't follow as closely. Similarly, corporate brands are most powerful in markets where consumers have little information, according to Itamar Simonsen, a marketing professor at Stanford, and Emmanuel Rosen, a former software executive. It could be because the product is somewhat technical, like toothpaste, since most consumers don't actually know what gel is best for their enamel, or because the product is refined, like wine, where studies have found that consumers prefer any vintage they think is expensive. But just as cable and the internet have washed away the power of political authorities, challenging the theory that the party decides, the internet's flood of information is also diluting the brand power of several consumer products. Consider the market for flat-screen televisions. There are only a few relevant details about a big screen that projects images, like width and resolution. Anybody can find those details online. So who needs to consult the plastic name at the bottom of the screen? No wonder, then, that the business of selling flat-screen televisions has been a disaster. The price of TVs declined 95% between 1994 and 2014. In that same period, Sony's television unit lost money every single year. When consumers don't know the true value of the products they're looking for, they rely on corporate iconography to guide them. But when they can figure out the absolute value of a product on their own, they ignore advertisements and brands. That's why Simonsen and Rosen have named their theory absolute value. The internet, they say, will be a brand assassinating technology, flooding the world with information and drowning out the signal of advertising for many products. In the 1890s, a single museum had the power to set an artistic canon. In the 1950s, a handful of television channels had the power to brighten every living room with a vision of the president. No more. Cable television drowned the bully pulpit. Social media is eroding the parties. The internet drowns out corporate branding. In all sorts of markets, music, film, art, and politics, the future of popularity will be harder to predict as the broadcast power of radio and television democratizes and the channels of exposure grow. Today, there are so many platforms that nobody, not the president, not the Republican Party, not Coca-Cola, can hope to own them all at once. The gatekeepers had their day. Now, there are simply too many gates to keep. The power of exposure is pervasive, from art and music to politics and brands. But its origin is elusive. How does familiarity shapeshift into pleasure so that I liken this to something else becomes simply I like this? In his 1790 treatise, Critique of Judgment, Immanuel Kant proposed that pleasure can arise from a free play of the mind. When a person discovers an attractive idea or story, it triggers a dialogue between imagination and understanding, each quickening the other. According to free play, beautiful art, music, and ideas offer a kind of cognitive tease. They dangle the promise of comprehension, but never provide the full satisfaction of getting it. Free play is a lovely idea. How pretty to think that our thoughts and feelings have dancing partners. And perhaps it is more than philosophical poetry. 2 centuries after Kant's treatise, psychologists developed the idea of metacognition. They proposed that there is a level of thinking above thinking. People have thoughts about their thoughts and feelings about their feelings. Have you ever heard somebody say, "This is hurting my brain"? It's often a joke, but it acknowledges something quite real. In a way, we can feel our thoughts. Some of them feel easy, like imagining words that rhyme with hat, listening to simple repetitive music, or hearing an eloquent argument for a political position one already agrees with. But sometimes thinking feels like work. Like imagining words that rhyme with strategy, listening to avant-garde electronica without a time signature, or processing a complex argument for a political position one considers abhorrently wrong. There is a psychological term for thinking that feels easy, and fortunately, it's easy to remember, too. It's called fluency. Fluent ideas and products are processed faster, and they make us feel better. Not just about ideas and products we confront, but also about ourselves. Most people generally prefer ideas they already agree with, images that are easy to discern, stories that are easy to relate to, and puzzles that are easy to solve. One of the most important sources of fluency is familiarity. A familiar idea is simpler to process and place in the mental map. When people see an artwork that reminds them of something they've been taught is famous, they feel the thrill of recognition and attribute the thrill to the painting itself. When they read a political argument that reflects their biases, it fits snugly into their story of how the world works. Thus, familiarity, fluency, and fact are inextricably linked. That idea sounds familiar. That idea feels right, and that idea is good and true, spill into each other in one mental mush. But not all thinking feels so easy. Some ideas, images, and symbols are more difficult to process, and the term for hard thinking is called disfluency. Just as the mental mush conflates fluency with good ideas, people tend to consider disfluency a sign that something is wrong. There is a play-it-at-home game to explain this effect. Follow these 4 steps. 1. Think of the last movie, play, or TV show that you finished. Whisper it to yourself. 2. Between 1, awful, and 10, perfect, imagine how you might rate it. 3. Now think of 7 specific things you liked about the movie or show. Count them on your fingers and don't stop until you hit 7. 4, finalize your rating of the show. This sort of game is famous because something curious often happens. Between steps 2 and 4, the rating typically goes down. Why should one's opinion of a show decline as you think of more reasons to like it? After a few easy examples come to mind, the effort to dig out more examples becomes palpably difficult. People experience disfluency, and sometimes they misattribute the feeling of disfluency to the quality of the show itself. This is the less is more or less is better effect. It means that less thinking leads to more liking. A cheeky UK experiment found that British students' opinion of former Prime Minister Tony Blair sank as they listed more of his good qualities. Spouses offer higher appraisals of their partners when asked to name fewer charming characteristics. When something becomes hard to think about, people transfer the discomfort of the thought to the object of their thinking. Almost every piece of media people consume, every purchase they make, every design they confront, lives on a continuum between fluency and disfluency, ease of thinking and difficulty of thinking. Most people lead lives of quiet fluency. They listen to music that sounds like the music they've already heard. They look forward to movies with characters, actors, and plots that they recognize. They don't heed political ideas from opposing parties, particularly if these ideas also seem painfully complicated. As we'll hear in the next chapter, this is a shame, because the greatest joys often come from discovering fluency in places you didn't expect. Fluency's attraction is obvious, but there is a quieter truth. People need a bit of its opposite. They want to be challenged, shocked, scandalized, forced to think, just a bit. They enjoy what Kant called free play, not just a monologue of fluency, but a dialogue between I get it and I don't and I want to know more. People are complicated, curious and conservative, hungry for new things and biased toward the familiar. Familiarity is not the end. It's just the beginning. This might be the most important question for every creator and maker in the world. How do you make something new if most people just like what they know? Is it possible to surprise with familiarity? Chapter 2. The Maya Rule. Aha moments in television, technology, and design. Decades before he would be known as one of the great hitmakers of the 20th century, Raymond Loewy was a French orphan aboard the SS France in 1919 with a personally tailored army uniform and $40 in his pocket. His parents had died during the influenza pandemic. World War I had ended. At the age of 25, Loewy was looking to start fresh in New York, perhaps, he thought, as an electrical engineer. As he was crossing the Atlantic Ocean, a gentle nudge from a stranger redirected his career. Several passengers were auctioning off some of their possessions for easy money. Owning nothing of value, Loewy contributed a pen and ink sketch of a female passenger strolling along the promenade deck. The drawing sold for 150 francs to the British consul in New York, who gave the young Loewy a contact in the big city, Mr. Condé Nast, the prestigious magazine publisher. The more Loewy thought about the invitation, the more intrigued he was by the idea of pursuing art as a living. When Loewy reached Manhattan, his older brother Maximilian took him to 120 Broadway. One of New York's largest structures in the early 1900s, the Equitable Building is a neoclassical skyscraper with two connected towers that ascend from a shared base like a giant tuning fork. He rode the elevator to the observatory platform 40 stories up and took in his first look down the gaping mouth of New York City and its toothy skyline. The engineer in Lowy was astonished by what he saw. New York was full of new stuff. Towers, trolleys, automobiles, and boats. He could hear ferries whistling from the Hudson River. But when the artist looked closer, he was crestfallen. New York was a grungy product of the machine age, greasy, crude, and hulking. He had imagined such different shapes aboard the SS France. Simple, slender, even feminine. The world below would soon reflect Lowy's dreamy vision. Within a few decades of his arrival, he would be widely known as the father of modern design. He would help remake the sports car, the modern train, and the Greyhound bus. He would design the Coca-Cola fountain and the iconic Lucky Strike cigarette pack. His firm put its imprimatur on products as prosaic as the pencil sharpener and as ethereal as the first NASA orbital workshop. In 1950, Cosmopolitan magazine wrote, "Lowy has probably affected the daily life of more Americans than any man of his time." Today, it is hard to walk through some cities, offices, or homes without seeing a product designed by Apple. In the 1950s, it was equally impossible to move through America without bumping into something designed by Lowy and his firm. At a time when American tastes were in violent flux, Lowy had what must have seemed like an ineffable sense of what people like. He also had a grand theory of it. He called it Maya. People gravitate to products that are bold, yet instantly comprehensible. Most advanced, yet acceptable. Unbeknownst to the now deceased Lowy, this insight has since been validated by a fleet of studies in the last 100 years. It's been used to explain earworms in pop music, blockbusters in movie theaters, and even the success of memes in digital media. It is not merely the feeling that something is familiar. It is one step beyond that. It is something new, challenging, or surprising that opens a door into a feeling of comfort, meaning, or familiarity. It is called an aesthetic aha. Raymond Lowy arrived in Manhattan at a key moment in the collision between economics and art. Artisans and designers of the 19th century had struggled to make enough stuff to meet the growing demand of consumers. But modern factories, with their electricity, assembly lines, and scientifically calibrated workflow, produced an unprecedented supply of identical cheap goods by the 1920s. It was an era of mass production, yielding an abundance of self-same products. Henry Ford's Model T was a symbol of its age, and from 1914 to 1925, it was available only in black. Companies did not yet worship at the altars of style, choice, and design. The era's capitalists were monotheistic. Efficiency was their one true god. But in the 1920s, art made a comeback, albeit for commercial reasons. It had become clear that factories could make more than consumers could buy. Americans were still neophobic, afraid of the new, and resistant to change. Capitalists needed buyers to be neophilic, attracted to the new, and so hungry for the next big thing that they'd spend their month's income on it. It was a period when American industrialists were learning that to sell more products, you couldn't just make them practical. You had to make them beautiful, even cool. Executives like Alfred Sloan, the CEO of General Motors, recognized that by changing a car's style and color every year, consumers might be trained to crave new versions of the same product. This insight, to marry the science of manufacturing efficiency and the science of marketing, inspired the idea of planned obsolescence. That means purposely making products that will be fashionable or functional for only a limited time in order to encourage repeat shopping trips. Across the economy, companies realized that they could engineer turnover and multiply sales by constantly changing the colors, shapes, and styles of their goods. Technology enabled choices, and choices created fashion. That perpetual hype cycle where designs and colors and behaviors appear suddenly cool and then suddenly anachronistic. It was an age of new things, a birth of American neophilia. Artists, once silenced by the whir of assembly belts churning out identical products, played a starring role in the new mass production economy. Designers became the conjuring artists of the consumerist American dream. For many people today, craving the next hit from Nike, Apple, or Disney feels as natural as awaiting the turning of the leaves. But this is no ancient Darwinian itch. For millennia, the ancestors of today's fashionistas wore the same clothes, and the sons of each generation didn't seem to mind wearing the tunics of their great-grandfathers. Fashion, as we know it, was not written into human DNA. It is a recent invention of mass production and modern marketing. People had to be taught to constantly crave so many new things, and Lowy was one of neophilia's first great teachers. Paul Heckert, a professor of industrial design and psychology, received a grant several years ago to develop a grand theory for why people like what they like, a unified model of aesthetics. Heckert's grand theory begins with two competing pressures. On the one hand, humans seek familiarity because it makes them feel safe. On the other hand, people are charged by the thrill of a challenge, powered by a pioneer lust. Our ancestors didn't just walk out of Africa. They also walked out of the Middle East and out of the Balkans and out of Asia and out of North America. Humans have climbed the peak of Mount Everest and descended to the nadir of the Mariana Trench. They have radical curiosity, crossed with conservative minds. This battle between discovery and familiarity affects us on every level, Heckert said, not just our preferences for pictures and songs, but also for ideas and even people. In studies, Heckert and his team asked respondents to rate several products like cars, telephones, and tea kettles for their typicality, novelty, and aesthetic preference. That is, for familiarity, surprise, and liking. The researchers found that neither measure of typicality nor novelty alone had much to do with most people's preference. Only taken together did they consistently predict the designs that people said they liked. When we started the study, we didn't even know about Raymond Loewy's theory, Heckert told me. It was only later that somebody told us that our conclusions had already been reached by a famous industrial designer, and it was called Maya. Raymond Loewy dreamed of forward motion. Doodles of cars and trains filled out his childhood sketchbooks. Even in the trenches of war, the darkest corners of life received his light touch. As a 21-year-old private in World War I, Loewy had decorated his dugout with flowered wallpaper and draperies, according to Time magazine. When the U.S. military standard-issued trousers didn't fit to his liking, he sewed himself a new pair of pants because, in his words, "I enjoyed going into action well-dressed." But in the United States, Loewy initially felt stuck. In the early 1920s, he worked as a fashion illustrator for Condé Nast, the magazine publisher, and Wanamaker, the department store. For several years, he was overworked and lonely. "Never a date, never any fun," he wrote. He spent long hours sketching in his studio apartment on West 57th Street, often until dawn, when the familiar clomping of the milkman's horses served as a reminder to lay the pencils to bed. Loewy had devoted himself to drawing, but he felt his attention wandering back to engineering, to polish the grimy city that stretched out before him on his first afternoon in New York. He was fixated on the heinous design of a mass-produced world, its boxy cars, its dusty refrigerators. "Why manufacture ugliness by the mile," he wrote, "and swamp the world with so much junk?" Finally, in 1929, he received his first design request from Sigmund Gestetner, a British manufacturer of early printers known as mimeographs. Gestetner asked if Lowy had any ideas to tweak the machine's appearance. Naturally, Lowy had more than a few suggestions. His initial reaction to the duplicator was visceral disgust. "Unwrapped and standing naked in front of me, it looked like a very shy, unhappy machine. It was a kind of dirty black, and it had a rather fat little body perched too high on four spindly legs that suddenly spread out in panic as they approached the earth. What looked like 400,000 little gadgets, spinners, springs, levers, gears, caps, screws, nuts, and bolts were covered in a mysterious bluish down that looked like the mold on tired Gorgonzola. Given only 3 days to operate, Lowy got to work. He redesigned the crank and the tray, chopped off the four spindly legs, and covered as much of the machine as possible in a removable shell made of plastic clay. Lowy had never used a duplicator before he was instructed to fix decades of bad engineering in 72 hours. But when Gestetner saw the clay model, he immediately shipped it to UK headquarters. The company didn't merely accept Lowy's design. It kept him on retainer for the rest of his career. Lowy's approach belonged to an emerging philosophy called industrial design, which had a dual mandate to make mass-manufactured products more efficient and more lovely. A great industrial designer served as both engineering consultant and consumer psychologist, equally aware of assembly routines and shopping habits. But the concept of industrial design itself required a bit of familiarization for machine-age companies. Lowy spent much of the 1930s traveling to Toledo, Cleveland, and Chicago to beg small Midwestern factories to look at his sketches. In aspirin-fueled business trips, Lowy would present his ideas before dozens of manufacturers, most of whom ignored him. His personal motto was that success is 25% inspiration and 75% transportation. Lowy's first break was in duplication, but his first coup was in refrigeration. In 1934, Sears Roebuck and Company asked him to redesign their cold spot fridge. Lowy accepted $2,500 and spent three times that amount moving the motor and installing the first ever rust-free aluminum shelves. The new design was a sensation. Within 2 years, Sears' annual sales quadrupled from 60,000 fridges to 275,000. His next breakthrough came in locomotives. The president of Pennsylvania Railroad approached the young designer with a deal. If Lowy could come up with a better way for passengers to dispose of waste at its grand New York City terminal, Pennsylvania Station, he would get a chance to design the trains themselves. Lowy accepted enthusiastically. The young man who fussed over wartime wallpaper was more than equipped to beautify a train station's trash cans. He spent 3 days immersing himself in amateur anthropology at Penn Station, studying the waste disposal habits of its violent current of passengers and staff. Pennsylvania Railroad enthusiastically welcomed his suggestions and awarded him the opportunity to redesign the company's most popular locomotive. He suggested eliminating thousands of rivets by welding a shell, a single smooth chromatic skin for the whole machine. His train designs are now iconic, the round head and slender body, the shape of a bullet fired through water. His talents stretched to logos. In the early months of 1940, George Washington Hill, the president of American Tobacco Company, bet $50,000 that Loewy couldn't improve Lucky Strike's iconic green and red cigarette packaging. Loewy sketched an alternative that kept the font, the red target, and the slogan, "It's Toasted." He then replaced the green background with white and copied the logo on the reverse of the cigarette pack so that the company's seal would always show face up, doubling its brand impressions. That April, Loewy invited Hill back to his office and showed him the new designs. He won the bet on the spot, and the white Lucky Strike design lasted the remainder of the century. In the next few decades, Loewy's firm would go on to design several of the most famous logos in America, including Exxon, Shell, and the U.S. Postal Service. These successes with Gestetner, Sears, Pennsylvania Railroad, and Lucky Strike opened his firm's doors to all varieties of design products: ferry boats, furniture, toothpick wrappers, bridges, coffee cups, menu designs, and store interiors. Loewy was mad for all sorts of undulations, but the prettiest curve, he liked to tell executives, was a sales curve that swept up and rightward. Loewy's most memorable designs were the body shells of his cars. Early in his career, Loewy had patented a sketch of a sedan. The prevailing style of cars in the 1920s was upright and boxy, a stagecoach with an engine. But the silhouette of Loewy's early car sketches anticipated the automobile's future. They featured a subtle forward lean, as if the upright Model T were set in italics. "Even standing still," Loewy said, "a car ought to have built-in forward motion." In the 1950s, his work with the auto manufacturer Studebaker produced perhaps the most famous work attributed to him. The Starliner Coupe, nicknamed the Loewy Coupe, is one of the most famous automotive designs of the 20th century. The body of the car, long and angular, rises to present two wide-open eyes for headlights. It is exactly as the younger Loewy imagined cars might one day look, set in motion, even when sitting still. In March 1962, he witnessed President John F. Kennedy's plane landing at the airport near his home in Palm Springs. That evening, he told a friend and White House aide that the plane looked terrible and gaudy. Someone took the hint, and Loewy was invited to the White House. He presented some livery sketches of America's most famous airplane to the president. Kennedy looked across the designs and selected a red and gold variety, with one special request. Kennedy asked that the design be rendered in his favorite color, blue. Loewy took the president's suggestion. The blue version of the livery he showed President Kennedy adorns the Air Force One 747 to this day. As the designer laureate of mid-century America, Loewy and his firm touched every station in the life cycle of American appetites. They designed international harvester tractors that farmed the Great Plains, merchandise racks at Lucky Store supermarkets that held the produce, kitchen cabinets in suburban homes that kept the food, the Frigidaire ovens that cooked the meals, and the Singer vacuum cleaners that ingested the crumbs of dinner. As a designer for Soviet companies in the depths of the Cold War, Loewy's design instincts transcended ideologies and hemispheres. At the end of his career, he was not even bound by the atmosphere. NASA asked Loewy's firm for help in designing the habitat inside its first space station, Skylab. Loewy's company conducted extensive habitability studies and concluded that orbiting astronauts would appreciate a reminder of the most familiar thing on Earth: Earth itself. It was Loewy who insisted on the inclusion of a viewing porthole, so that astronauts could sneak a peek at their pale blue home. And so the designer's career ended as it began, looking down from a great height and imagining something more beautiful. Loewy's final contribution to design was literally a new way to see the world. Raymond Loewy's shop was, as much as any modern music label or Hollywood studio, a hit factory of his time. Photographs from the 1950s show a world sheathed in smooth chrome. Loewy won